specific detail, though small at face value, is itself a crushing defeat for the Zionist regime, which will now officially in international law and history have its name tethered to word genocide. The top UN court issued provisional measures for the Zionist regime to be taken immediately. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall, in accordance with its obligations under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in relation to the Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the Article 2 of the Convention, in particular, A. killing members of the group, B. causing serious bodily or mental harm to the members of the group, C. deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and D. imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall ensure with immediate effect that its military does not commit any acts described in point 1 above. By 16 votes to 1, Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. By 16 votes to 1, Israel shall take immediate and effective measures to ensure the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence related to allegations of acts within the scope of Article 2 and Article 3 of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide against members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall submit a report to the court on all measures taken to give effect to this order within 1 month, as from the date of the order. Much to the chagrin of many, both in Palestine and elsewhere, the provisional measures did not call for a ceasefire. The Zionist regime's aggression on the population of Gaza during the time of this issue has led to the murder of over 26,000 Palestinians, nearly half of them children, and thousands more trapped under the rubble still unaccounted for. The ICJ has acknowledged that genocidal crimes may be happening, but denying the Palestinians a ceasefire or not placing any independent mechanism to enforce the cessation of these hostilities has created a situation that tells on itself how limited its power is, at least for the Palestinian cause. The provisional measures also ask for the Tel Aviv occupation to report on itself and for it to hold itself accountable. Per the first ruling, Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, leading up to the court decision, commented on the aggression on Gaza, saying, "No one will stop us, not the Hague, not the axis of evil, and no one else. It is possible and necessary to continue until victory, and we will do it." Clearly, the child killer regime of Israel cannot be trusted to uphold the provisional measures from the very get-go. The Zionist regime has rejected and mocked the court and the UN as a whole, using its usual go-to smear of painting any of its opponents as anti-Semites. Despite these shortcomings, we must give credit where it is due. not to the courts, but to the South African legal team who prepared an airtight case against the Zionist regime using the Zionist regime's own genocidal words and actions. With any crime of this caliber, the harder thing to do is to prove the intent of the crime. South Africa's legal team used Israeli officials' own statements and clips posted by Zionist troops in Gaza to force the court to proceed forward with the case, where the Tel Aviv regime's strategy was to throw the case out entirely. The case was built with precision. All but one judge supported the provisional measures, Julia Sebutine from Uganda. The government of Uganda immediately moved to distance itself from her. Indeed, the court decision has shown the world the limitations of the so-called rules-based order and of international appendages, but it also highlights the growing international isolation of the Zionist regime when held to account by an airtight case. The United States, Canada, the UK, and the EU have all stood in complete defense of the Zionist occupation throughout this entire legal dispute, with the United States calling South Africa's case meritless. The court moving forward with South Africa's use of the Genocide Convention pushes these countries, on the record, to one side of history while holding the Palestinian cause on another. Many countries have lined up behind South Africa and therefore Palestine, knowing full well that the time to take sides on the international stage is now. It is also worth noting that on the same day, this decision was delivered, the US, UK, Australia and Canada, all countries who have given unfettered support to the Zionist regime, cut off all funding from the UN appendage UNRWA, which provides vital support to Palestinians suffering in Gaza. The countries cite unverified Zionist claims that UNRWA employees were part of the October 7th military operation against Israeli occupation bases. However, given the timing of the UN decision and the Zionist smear campaign against the world body as a whole, it is clear this is politically motivated in order to punish the UN and send a message. As the Israeli occupation continues its horrific massacres and, yes, ongoing genocide against Gaza, more countries will feel inclined to move away from the Zionist regime, especially as legal proceedings advance. Think of it as holding your hand to a fire. Most sensible people know not to do this, but only the most arrogant people will insist on doing so, despite the severe burns it may cause. South Africa also intends to take the US and the UK to court for its complicity in the Gaza genocide. Clear lines are being drawn using the US own rules and order against it. For Palestinians and freedom fighters across the world, this legal scenario does indeed highlight the trajectory of growing extinction of so-called Western rules-based order, but all the while demonstrating the ineffectiveness of its own established organs. Where these organs are quick to act for US interest, they offer less than enthusiastic risk slaps when clear genocide is being conducted by a regime that does not care for rules. Indeed, there is no substitute for underground resistance. As the Zionist aggression continues, you can count on the axis of resistance to continue to deliver the necessary blows to the Israeli occupation in the court of Palestinian justice.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Yasser, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. It was a pleasure to be with you, Brother Mohammed Jawad.
Thank you very much, and Sayyid Abdullah, thank you very much, and welcome to the studio.
Welcome, Sam, bro. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
It was a pleasure.
You're welcome. From the last episode onwards, we started criticizing a movie with a religious theme. Actually, it was about witchcraft. That is called Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. We're going to continue criticizing this movie. But before that, let's take a short listen to a part of this movie, and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
Did you miss me? You have, haven't you? Don't try to deny it. I can see into your soul.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser helping me as my guest speakers in the studio criticize the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Brother Yasser, there is a conversation between the knight, Master Grigori, and the demon, basically the witch or the queen of the dark, suggested by the movie in different parts, of course, who claims, the demon says, "I can see into your soul." Is that correct? Can demons see into the souls of human beings?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Again, understanding the movie is a movie of fantasy. What do we mean by soul in the movie compared to what soul is meant by in Islamic or religious concept is maybe different. For example, soul just might be a person's thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I can read your thoughts. Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay, that's not something extreme or something difficult. Human beings can do that to other human beings. They have someone can have the ability to do that, to kind of just pick up. For example, even us, for example, you can pick up certain vibes. You start pick up a certain vibe from somebody. Right? So you know that. It's just something natural that happens, right? Have the ability to do that because of the demeanor of the person, the act of the person, whatever else you see from that person, the face expression of the person.
Mm-hmm.
So in this sense, first of all, what you mean by soul here, it may not mean like the soul that we mean, the ruh or the spirit or the essence of a human being.
Yes.
Yeah, it just may be a person's thoughts or a feelings and emotions of a person, which obviously love is one of them. Again, what we mean by soul in Islamic theology or in even religious theology is something very difficult to actually discuss and to understand. Throughout history of religion, there have been different opinions of what a soul actually is. Contemporarily or in the current era, most of the Islamic philosophers use the Sadrin model of what the soul is, which obviously this is not the platform to discuss that particular model. But in this particular movie, in this particular thing, I don't think what is meant here is soul as per the essence of a human being. It's more like the thoughts and emotions of a person, which is not something that difficult to do, something that me and you can, we do it all the time as well.
I see.
So, yeah. But in terms of the other one, seeing into a person's soul, if you really want to know it, a person can only do that if they have what is known as saitara, or a encompassing of that person's soul in their own being.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, like you have encompassed the existence or the essence of that person within you,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
I see.
So, it's like one of the examples I would always give is the examples of those Russian dolls. You know, you have a doll within a doll, and then another doll within the doll as well. So, is that only then will we be able to truly understand the essence of another person, because it is attached to you. Other than that, no, it's not possible at all to kind of know that soul or the essence of another person.
You know, in terms of different ideologies and different, tradition, whether you're talking about like the world mysticism, there's a distinction made between the soul and the spirit, right? The spirit is that transcendental, immaterial part of human being, whereas the soul is the eminent, immaterial part, which is lower in comparison, like in level, right? Or in terms of different mystical realms and planes. But when you refer to, for example, the Eastern type of mentality or mysticism, for example, they are talking about like the different layers of human beings, like the seven, sometimes up to 12, or even I've seen 22 layers of human beings. Of course, some of them transcend the human beings. Like seven of them, in fact, stay within the human body, like starting from the root, for example, the chakras, and then going up and up to the crown chakra, and even upper than the head of the person. So there are different kinds of distinctions, right? Or different kinds of classifications given in terms of like the soul, the spirit, or if the other layers.
So what is easier to understand it is that there's one reality, one thing, but has different modes of looking at it. Like, for example, even if you look at it in an Islamic or anything, the soul has different faculties. So there's one thing, one reality, and it has different things that it does. It's one thing. It is not something different. It's not you have three, four different souls or three, four different spirits. It's one thing that has different faculties, or a particular aspect of that soul is doing something. So even when it comes to Hinduism or when it comes to Buddhism, it's the same concept. One reality. But the reality in connection of what is being seen is different. Like, for example, you have this thing like in Buddhism, this you have, even they say to achieve nirvana, you have to ensure that your soul becomes one with the higher reality.
Yeah, they achieve union.
But that union is what? Is that your soul and all its aspects come to an equilibrium. It's one reality, but all the aspects of one reality comes to, for example, even Islamic ethics, we have that. You have the three faculties of lust, of, what's the other one? Anger, and of the intellect. You have those three.
Yes.
So a person reaches equilibrium when he's able to take these three faculties, which are all part of one reality, and put them in equilibrium and reach what is known as become I don't know what it is, itidal.
Yeah, Aristotelian temperance.
Temperance. So he reaches itidal,
yeah,
or this equilibrium.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's one reality. And even, for example, in Islamic mysticism, in essence, the spirit of the soul, the spirit of the soul is one reality. It's just two aspects of how you're looking at that one reality.
Mm.
Are you looking at that one reality as a, you know, as a metaphysical reality? Or are you looking at it as a physical reality? But it's, at the end of the day, it is one reality that has two aspects to it.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. And then we'll be back with his criticism. Don't go away.
I'm sorry, Master. Permission is vago!
Para Isenex!
No! Master Gregory!
Permission!
Don't expect sympathy from him. His heart's blacker than mine. You're with me now.
Let him go!
I can feel the dark.
No!
I can't stand it.
Let him go! I will burn you!
Master Gregory!
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah helping me as my guest speakers criticize the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Sayyid Abdullah, in this part of the movie, the demon or the evil witch captures the boy, the knight's assistant or apprentice, the old one, of course, in a metal cage. The knight sets fire to her, to the demon or the witch, but she doesn't burn. Is that because the jinns, this is what I'm reminded of, because the jinns are made of fire, kind of fire, of course.
Yes.
So they cannot be burned with fire?
Well, I mean, technically speaking, yes. You can't burn fire with fire. So jinn in their essence, but I mean that's if we're being very literal, because even though jinn are made from fire, it's like if they present themselves today, you're not gonna see like a flame.
Uh-huh.
You're gonna see like a different, like we, the Quran says we made it from clay, but there's no, not even a trace of clay in our body.
Yeah,
like technically speaking, because we're flesh and bone and blood.
Yeah,
so our initial creation was like that. So, jinn now, would they be able to, can you burn them in fire? Perhaps, because, like I said, even though their true essence was, you can kill me with the clay, right?
Yes.
Because even though I made it from clay, but you can still kill me with the clay. Yeah. So, with jinn, would you be able, I don't know, no one has killed a jinn to tell us how they killed him or they burnt him. However, the Quran mentions something very important. When the samawat was locked and yes, the jinn cannot access the realm and they cannot see the malaika, the Quran says any jinn that tries to cross, we will send a shuhab, right? Like a comet, which is like a burning comet that kills them. So maybe at the end of the day.
Yeah, in the astral realm.
Yeah.
Of course. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014, and then we'll be back with his criticism. Don't go away.
The ward residents!
Who's asking?
I understand there's a seventh son of a seventh son that lives here. Do not say there is not, for I know that there is. I'm in a hurry.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser, helping me criticize the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Brother Yasser, in that part of the movie, the knight, Master Gregory, seeks to find a seventh son. This is where the movie actually gets its title from. After losing his apprentice, the last apprentice that was killed by the demon or the witch, what's so special about the seventh son? Is it for real? Does the order of the birth affect magic or exorcism?
I think, again, because what we're dealing with here is a fantasy movie. But if you want to look at it in a very general kind of way, symbolism and numerology, yes, has a part to play
yes,
in the world we have. I mean, even in many teachings, religious or even non-religious teachings, you have numbers being involved.
Mm-hmm.
For example, why do you circumambulate the Kaaba 7 times? Why do you, for example, read 4 rakats in a particular salah?
Mm-hmm.
Why not 10? Why not 12? And so on and so forth. Why you read a particular surah this amount of times? 7. Mm-hmm. We have number 7 is very prominent in Islamic teachings. Yes. Very prominent.
Yes.
7, 14, 40, 12, 14. And these are just numbers. Don't know what they mean, but these are numbers that are very prominent.
As stated in the archetypes, even propounded or suggested by Carl Gustav Jung, you know, that he found certain qualities to be like in the DNA of human being. Even if you search the whole humanity and the history of mankind, you still find the same themes recurring.
Yeah, but in this instance, for example, what we are trying to understand is that does that particular number symbolize a particular reality that's beyond it?
Yes.
And one of the things that we have to understand is that in ancient Greek, the concept of the Pythagoras and Pythagorean philosophers based their entire philosophy on numbers. That a particular number represents something outside.
Yes.
Like 9 was a very powerful number. Why? It was the end. After that becomes what? You start joining up numbers. 1 and 0, 1 and 2, 1 and 3. So 9 was a number of infinity. Mm-hmm. Like in Islam, 7... Just because we think about 7, 7 is a number of abundance, of a lot.
I see.
So what's one of the things about 7? Why I do things 7 times? So again, yes, numbers are important. Unfortunately, it requires a lot of research into what it actually represents because they are just symbols.
And we also had sciences.
We have a science.
Like
Jafar, Ilm al-Jafar, new numerology. Where, yes, numerology, it is definitely there. It is definitely, but what it is, you need somebody who's an expert in it to truly understand it.
Thank you very much, Brother Yasser. And thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah, for your nice comments and answers to the questions and criticism of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, signing off. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
If you see a witch, kill it.
We're not all evil, you know.
I can't do this. I'm not like you.
Join us.
Food for thought.
Everyone, let us ponder on this short and sweet saying from Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Say good wording and it will be your distinctive feature. Do good deeds and you will be reckoned with its people.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Why Yemen?
Part 4.
On December 3, 2017, the Yemeni media announced that a cruise missile with a range of 1,600 kilometers had been fired towards the Barakah nuclear power plant in Abu Dhabi's western desert. Later, video of the missile strike was released, so all the media in regional countries were amazed. It sent a chill down the spine of the Emirati Sheikhdom. Although the Barakah wasn't operational at the time, and fuel rods were not injected into the nuclear plant, Ansarallah decided to show restraint and set the missile course in a way so it hit an open area several hundred kilometers away. However, it served as a reminder to the UAE leaders of the constant threat by the Yemeni army's long-range missiles against the facilities inside the UAE. After several months, when the conflicts in Al-Hudaydah heated up on July 26, 2018, Yemeni media sources reported a long-range Asamad drone targeted the Abu Dhabi airport. Abu Dhabi initially decided to put up a media gag on the incident, but after a while, the airport confirmed on X social media platform, formerly known as Twitter, that there was an incident involving a supply vehicle at the airport on July 26 at 4 p.m. and claimed incident had not affected the airport's operation. However, UAE officials categorically dismissed any drone attack on the airport. Less than a year, in May 2019, the truth came to light. The Al Masira television network somehow accessed and released the video recorded by security cameras at the airport while the Yemeni drone launched the suicide attack and exploded inside the airport. It was almost from that time onwards that the UAE army ruled out the option of getting directly engaged in military confrontation with popular Yemeni forces. Yemen has 15 islands in the Red Sea, Bab el-Mandab Strait, and the Arab Sea that are categorized as five archipelagos of Socotra, Hanish, Zubair, Kamaran, and Perim. Some of the islands have no inhabitants, and some others like Socotra and Kamaran have inhabitants. In March 2015, the Saudi-led coalition kicked off its war on Yemen. The heavy conflict inside Yemen sent tensions over ownership claims on the islands out of focus. But the Emirati leaders were after precise planning to occupy the islands and gain control over Bab el-Mandab and Socotra near the Indian Ocean. The presence of the UAE military in southern Yemen and northeastern coast of Africa and the occupation of the Yemeni islands in that region could give a strategic edge by controlling the maritime transportation through the Bab el-Mandab Strait. The defeat in the Al-Hudaydah port led to a ceasefire deal between the UAE and Sana'a-based government. Gradually, UAE decided to withdraw its forces but had an eye on another strategic region, the Socotra Island.
UAE, very active on Socotra, and also Oman, which has more deep historical ties in the east of the country, now supporting would-be Sultan of Al Mahra and Socotra. So we've got three international players there.
The Socotra Island has unique tourist attractions and flaunts its natural phenomena. before 2008, when UNESCO put the flora and fauna of the island on its list, it wasn't known to many people. The dream of the UAE leaders to gain control over Socotra dates back to a decade before the war on Yemen. Due to the unique geographical location of the island, the storms from the ocean hit the island and every time inflict huge damage on the infrastructure and the almost 60,000 inhabitants of the island. The UAE's presence on the island dates back to 2000 when a strong storm hit the island. The UAE's Red Crescent sent a few planes carrying humanitarian aid to the island. Abu Dhabi has been seeking to gain a foothold on the island ever since. 8 months after the Yemen war was launched, in November of 2015, Cyclone Meg struck Socotra. The cyclone was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for the UAE Army so they could deploy their military forces and station them on the ground under the pretext of sending aid to the island. As of October 2016, 31 cargo airplanes and a few logistics ships containing food and medical supplies were sent to the people living on the island. At the same time, they increased the number of Emirati forces on the island as well. On April 30th, 2018, the UAE's military planes and warships occupied Socotra and took control of the airport and the pier on the port of the island. About 100 UAE military forces were stationed in sensitive locations on the island and grabbed complete control over the island. Saudi Arabia and the former government of Mansour Hadi protested the move by their former Arab allies. It triggered heavy conflicts between the two sides in southern Yemen. It left thousands of forces from both sides dead or wounded in different areas, including Aden and Shawba. Two weeks after the occupation of Socotra by the UAE, after Riyadh and supporters of Mansour Hadi ramped up pressure, the UAE army agreed to hand over the administrative control of the island to the resigned government of Mansour Hadi, but it still had military control over the island and airport.
The Emiratis see this as an opportunity to demonstrate some real kind of Arab-style nation-building. Economic, rebuild them, and they see the ports as the fundamental way to do this. So now the Emiratis control the port of Mukalla that we talked about earlier, they took back from AQAP, the port of Aden, port of Mocha. If Hodeidah gets resolved, then they control the port of Hodeidah on the Red Sea. So all the major ports are now basically under Emirati control. Think of Dubai Ports World.
In the summer in 2019, the UAE started to pull its forces out of southern Yemen, a process that took until February of 2020 when they announced that the last batch of official forces was withdrawn from the port of Aden. The occupation of the Socotra island and the withdrawal of the Emirati forces from Yemen were heavy blows that Abu Dhabi dealt against Riyadh amid the Yemen war. It aroused the wrath of Saudi leaders. After the skirmishes on the southern front ceased and UAE forces withdrew from Yemen, the Saudi army and forces under its command in northern Yemen were being crushed under the heavy strikes by the Yemeni army and popular forces, so they retreated from large oil-rich areas in Al-Jaf and Ma'arib. Saudi Arabia and Mansour Hadi's former government blamed Emirati stab in their back for the retreat, but the UAE leaders knew very well that Saudi Arabia could no longer be their reliable ally in their greater plot in the Bab al-Mandab region. So, they were looking for a new partner or a regional power to complete their plan, and for this reason, they ganged up with the Israeli regime.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate. Dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum. Welcome to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. The 10 days between February 1st or Bahman 12 and February 11th on 1977 are called Fajr Decade, which Imam Khomeini entered to Iran after 15 years of exile, and the greatest welcome in history took place from him in Tehran, and eventually the Pahlavi regime was extinct after more than 50 years of oppression and tyranny on February 23rd. This is today's special on 21st of Rajab, 1445 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 13th of Bahman, 1402 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 2nd of February, 2024 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. This is Chapter Baqara, verse 153.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. يا أيها الذين آمنوا استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة إن الله مع الصابرين.
O you who have believed, seek help through patience and prayer. Indeed, Allah is with the patient.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Real faith can never be mere empty words. It must express or manifest itself through patience or endurance in all that befalls the individual to show his faithfulness to Allah, and the help from Allah must be sought through prayers or supplications to the Lord. The objective meaning of the phrase Allah is with the patient ones is that his help, assistance, guidance, success, favors, the protection from pests, the perfection of intentions, as well as his other blessings, are showered upon the patient by him.
In the month of Bahman, the month of Islamic Revolution, be with today's special.
We're going to speak about the resistance of the revolution, one of the reasons for the astonishing impact of the Islamic nature of the revolution. Is the resistance of the revolution and continuation of victory against a multitude of hostilities. If the revolution had not relied on Islam and the divine faith, it would have definitely failed against all varied, complicated animosities, or at least Islam has turned into an American brand, American Islam, which exists in most part of the world and no one is hostile to it. Ayatollah Khamenei in this regard states, despite all opposition since the early days of the victory of the Islamic revolution, the Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation have overcome various forms of their enemies and defeated them.
We
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. In this visual, we shall be talking about the Islamic revolution and its difference with other revolutions. The revolution that happened in Iran. Fundamental characteristics of the Islamic revolution compared to other revolutions. In this regard, numerous points have been stated in various sources, but for brevity, we will refer to a few fundamental characteristics, first of which is level of political participation. Certainly, other revolutions also involve the people's presence. However, the role of the Iranian people, the revolution was unprecedented. The revolution was popular and nationwide, and all segments of the population across the country fully participated with their power and being, which was one of the most important reasons for the victory of the revolution and establishment of the Islamic Republic. Hamid Algar, who has authored works on the Islamic Revolution, says regarding people's participation, one of the characteristics of the Iranian Islamic Revolution was the extensive participation of the masses of people. In the French, Russian, and Chinese revolutions, the revolution was always accompanied by civil war.
IRIB English Radio in the month of Bahman presents
today's special. This is today's special, an Islamic Revolution Codes. Roger Garadi, a French Muslim scholar, describes the Islamic Revolution in Iran as this. Verily, the Islamic Revolution, led by Imam Khomeini, does not have any precedent in the past. The various social revolutions that took place in the various parts of the world over past course of time intended to change just certain political system. The Islamic Revolution of Iran included all these reasons, but it also carried new concepts and meanings as well. And continuation of today's special, Iran Islamic Revolution, Achievements of Four Decades, Great Freedom. The Islamic Revolution granted the Iranian nation freedom in various fields. The Iranian nation had been suppressed for centuries, especially during Pahlavi regime. Any dissent would be quenched and opponents would be jailed, tortured, and murdered. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, people are free to hold legal gatherings and meetings and express their opinion in various matters. The elected officials of the country, including the president, members of parliament, and city councils. They also elect the members of assembly of experts who appoint the leader. The massive turnout of the people at ballot boxes indicates that they use the best opportunity that the Islamic Republic has granted them to determine their fate. Moreover, religious minorities as part of the Iranian nation enjoy freedom and have representatives in the parliament. As for the media, the Islamic Revolution has granted freedom to the media to express their ideas and criticize the officials. Plus, after the Islamic Revolution, the written and audiovisual media have dramatically increased in number.
So what we witness today is that there is now a new world order that is emerging. It is not a unipolar world order. It is, in fact, a multipolar world order. In the past, there are only two world superpowers. It was Russia or Soviet Union and America. Once the Soviet Union disintegrated, the world was dominated by a unipolar world order. But today, we have Russia and China emerging to oppose the U.S. and its NATO allies, but at the same time, Islamic Iran and the resistance front are an important component of this emerging new multipolar world order. But the most significant point of all of this is that it is the Islamic Republic that is the leading figure, and because of its enormous mineral wealth, because of its enormous oil wealth, because of its enormous gas wealth, and to top it all of it, because of its enormous scientific talent that exists in Iran, that now we are witnessing the emergence of a new Islamic civilization in the world that is based on fairness, that is based on justice, that is based on bringing an end to the exploitation that has gone on in the world for the last 100 years or more. So we are on the threshold of the new beginning, and it is a hopeful beginning because now we are seeing the emergence of the Islamic civilization in its own right. And I'm very hopeful, the way I see the situation, that with the dollar hegemony broken, inshallah, we will see the emergence of the Islamic civilization. It's not going to be a one-day process. It will require a lot of sacrifices, a lot of effort, but all of the components of the emergence of this Islamic civilization are in place now. Imam Khomeini, rahimahullah, or his successor, Imam Khamenei, may Allah prolong his life, and we are seeing that the leadership is selfless. It is dedicated to the principles of Islam. And although they face a lot of challenges, but Islam's struggle has never been without challenges. Even if you go back into history at the time of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, Muslims faced enormous challenges. They were persecuted, they were tortured, they were killed, yet they stood steadfast. We are beginning to see that situation reoccurring in the world. And this is now, this gives us hope. And what it does is it places an enormous responsibility on the rest of us that we have to fulfill our responsibility. And that is, we must now join hands. We must rise above our sectarian interest. It's essential. It's absolutely essential. Because sectarianism is a disease that is going to destroy the Muslims. It has done so in the past, and it's a weapon that our enemies are using against us. And I think we have to rise above these sectarian tendencies. That doesn't mean that the Shias should give up being Shias or the Sunnis should give up being Sunnis. What it means is that we keep our differences to one side and we work on the aspects that unite us. And I think we can all agree that injustice is wrong, exploitation is wrong, we need equality, we need equity, we need justice in the world. And so we need to strive towards that, and we need to end the exploitation that is going on in the world so that the Muslims can emerge in their rightful place that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has designated for them. The Muslim world is endowed with enormous resources of energy, of minerals, and, you know, land area, of water resources, etc. The only thing is that these resources are being used by the enemies of Islam against the Muslims to keep the Muslims suppressed. And if we set aside our differences and unite on this common platform of Muslim unity, of Muslims being one ummah, there is no reason whatsoever in the world that we cannot emerge in our dominant role in the world, which is a role that has been designated to us by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Dear brothers and sisters, that was all for today. And inshallah, of course, we meet you soon in another episode of today's special. So we leave you in Allah's protection. Fi amanillah.
Ali, però è rampare di, calore un po' a chi, ma è perso, ma è perso!
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.